This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Now on Building Bridges, we talk with Dr. Cornel West, author of Race Matters, Democracy Matters, and Hope on a Tightrope, about America's continuing dialogue on race and justice, the Obama presidency, and the economic crisis. But first...
Dialogue in the face of death. Dialogue to ward off despair. Dialogue to sustain us against forms of domination. It's all about that democracy in action. Finding your voice, just your voice. All imitation is suicide. All emulation is adolescent. It's keeping that swing. Don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. But you got to swing like Muhammad Ali. And swing like Lester Young. Swing like Duke Ellington and Count Basie. A creative people. In unfree conditions, creating jazz. That jazz constitutes artistic aristocracy from ghettos and hoods, an artistic delicacy out of personal and social misery. Quest for excellence, fusion of high intelligence, deep spirituality, spontaneity and discipline, improvisation, and unbelievable sense of order.
Cornel West, as we approach an economic, social, and spiritual crossroads, the next chapter of the American story is about to be written. Now, Dr. Cornel West.
This is an intense period of time. I'm curious how you view the trajectory of white workers' thoughts during the primary period. And now, subsequent to the election and inauguration of Barack Obama, what do you think this means for race and race relationships in this country?
It's hard to say. There's no doubt that the vast majority of my white brothers and sisters in this country are less racist than they were just 10 years ago. Anytime you vote for a black man, the most powerful position in the country and the world, you have to wrestle with your own insecurities, fears, and anxieties. And in voting for him, you acknowledge that some of the lies that white supremacy has taught you have to be called into question. At the same time, it doesn't mean that white supremacy is over. It means that it's been pushed back. It has not been eliminated, but it certainly has been pushed back, and that is I think a moment for that warrants a moment of celebration, even as we become more fortified to engage in our struggle, not just against white supremacy, but against imperial power, against any form of injustice, wealth inequality, male supremacy, and especially, I should note, homophobia, because I don't want gay brothers and lesbian sisters to be left out in this concern about human suffering and human abuse.
Just to push that a little further, if I may. Why did they vote? It was still a relatively small number. It was the African-American vote. There were other votes that really carried the day. But why do you think they were able to overcome? And what does this say about our kind of traditional understanding about the conjuncture of issues of race and class? and the hoarding, really, or white privilege. Why did they overcome to some extent and move in the direction of Barack Obama?
I think we do have to recognize, I mean, I was there in Iowa. It was really Iowa that was the spark. And there you did have white workers making the difference. In fact, many of those votes of white workers convinced black people that Barack Obama had a winnable or a credible campaign. So I want to give the white workers in Iowa a lot of credit in that regard, no doubt. But at the same time, I think we have to recognize that the Democratic Party was relatively decrepit, mediocre, spineless. The only thing that Barack had to overcome was the Clinton machine. Clinton machine is a grand machine, but it found out that it was not almighty, it was just mighty. And from the very beginning, we decided that if we can beat the Clinton machine, we can win. And so in that regard, historically speaking, the Democratic Party had been triangulating for so long, imitating right-wing policy for so long, becoming more weak, more feeble, more vacuous, and in comes this brilliant, charismatic figure with tremendous rhetorical powers and a sense of financial support from a variety of different sources to win. And so it's a combination, I think, of those early white workers in Iowa, a decrepit Democratic Party, and a tremendous hunger and thirst in the party and in the nation for something new to bring the age of Reagan and the era of conservatism to an end.
And Barack takes power at a time of great economic crisis, rising unemployment. Is this the beginning of the end or the beginning of a new beginning?
It's hard to say. It's a good question. I think it's open-ended. I hope and pray that it's the beginning of something positive. I hope the age of Obama is, in fact, the age of what Sly Stone called empowering everyday people. But we just don't know. We've got to help him. We've got to push him. I don't want the American empire to collapse because there's some rich democratic possibilities and elements there, and there's some precious people. On the other hand, the empire is in deep trouble, very deep trouble. Imperial occupation in Iraq, wealth inequality at home, tremendous strife in the Middle East, Wall Street near collapse, a lack of confidence in the financial system, a whole host of different elements of this crisis that he has to come to terms with. So it could be the beginning of the end if he's not bold enough and courageous enough. But we should keep in mind, no FDR without the labor movement, no Lincoln without Frederick Douglass, no LBJ at his best without freedom fighters of people like Martin Luther King Jr., Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, Philip Berrigan. Social movements make a difference for elected officials.
And on what issues do you think he may need pushing?
He needs pushing on nearly every issue, from health care. There was no mention of universal health care in the inaugural address, right? Well, that's an invisibility that I don't appreciate as much as I like the speech, because so much of the campaign is about universal health care. No mention of it. He needs pushing on foreign policy in the Middle East. We need to make sure that we can wed the precious security of our Jewish brothers and sisters in Israel with the struggle for justice for our precious Palestinian brothers and sisters. He needs pushing on that. And there's a whole host of other issues.
I wonder, when you talk about pushing, mass movements certainly, but I was rather thunderstruck by people who I normally have an enormous respect for, Maxine Waters, John Lewis, less so perhaps, Tavis Smiley, more in the popular base. They weren't pushing. They weren't even in the corner of an African-American. Just, yes, because he was an incredibly strong African-American with certainly liberal left leanings.
Well, I wouldn't say left leanings. I think Brother Barack is a dying world liberal in that sense. But that's fine. That's fine.
I'm glad you said that.
Oh, yeah. No, he is who he is, and I love my brother. He just is who he is. I want him to be true to himself. But no, I think that someone like Brother Tavis Smiley is just continually calling for accountability across the board. I think what he saw was a kind of frenzy around Barack Obama that didn't allow Socratic sensibility, questioning, making sure that he is responsible and accountable as any politician. I think that's what was at work. And that's understandable. You get the frenzy because the black president's big, serious business, no doubt about that. But at the same time, every public official in a democracy must be accountable across the board, no matter what color. I think someone like Maxine Waters, John Lewis, they were just wedded to the establishment of the Democratic Party, which is a Clinton machine. Clinton machine has delivered for middle-class Negroes in significant ways, but it has also overlooked the needs of many poor people of all colors.
I don't personally believe that we're going to hip-hop the revolution, although I appreciate the contributions of hip-hop to the gathering of youth. What do you think is the catalyst that really is going to bring the kind of consciousness and activism of the youth movement to become part of that pushing and shoving in their own interest, as certainly we saw during civil rights, black power, and other movements?
It's hard to say. I mean, if Barack Obama, President Obama, my dear brother, were to promote a draft where all young people had to go to war and large numbers of them end up going to Afghanistan, as he augments the number of troops there, you're going to get a wave of activism among young people. That is to say, there are a variety of different kinds of events and circumstances that could activate the political consciousness of young people across color. We just don't know what they are right now. They have been captivated by the campaign, rightly so. I'm glad they did. But you just hope they don't go back to sleep. At this moment, it's hard to know exactly what it is that's going to sustain them, but that's one of the things that those of us who are concerned about ensuring that the age of Obama is the age of empowering everyday people. We don't want President Obama, my dear brother Barack Obama, to be reluctant to step into the age of Obama itself, to step into his own age. And there's a sense in which his tilt toward the Clintonites gives us some evidence that he's a bit reluctant. But I hope and pray that he's pushed. I think Sister Michelle's probably putting some pressure on him, too. Absolutely. Good pressure. Loving pressure.
We'll find out about Sasha Loving Malia pressure. And that.
Absolutely. Sasha Malia, too. Absolutely. Indeed, indeed. There was this, that precious moment when you saw Ms. Robinson, Michelle's precious mother, walk down that step with the two kids. It's like, good God, I mean, the symbols matter. Symbols are not playful things. They cut deep in the soul. And to see that is... it's really something. But it's not the same as substance. We got to get policy, good policy, progressive policy.
And getting back to the crisis and getting back to consciousness, how does the failure of capitalism itself affect the consciousness of the American people, of black workers, of white workers, toward the legitimacy of the whole system?
Well, I think in the kind of hyper-capitalism of the age of Ronald Reagan, where the definition of success is just becoming well-adjusted to injustice if you have a lot of material toys. So very notions of greatness that have to do with struggle for freedom and justice for others, especially the poor, so that people like Martin King and others are easily pushed to the margins or become these isolated icons that people invoke once a year but have very little impact on their lives the rest of the year. That is something that is gargantuan in terms of how one tries to turn that around. I think more than anything else, what we have, especially with Wall Street and the greed at the top, is this sense of living in a world of make-believe. It's almost like the American Hamlet of Blanche DuBois and Streetcar Named Desire by the white blues man Tennessee Williams, that we've been living in a world of make-believe, and this hyper-capitalism is supposed to deliver for everybody. We knew it wasn't true. We knew it was a lie. But people believed it anyway. Now that house of cards, that world of make-believe, has been shattered, just like Blanche DuBois. And very much like Cheney ends up in a wheelchair. That's where Blanche ends up, in a wheelchair. Humbled, acknowledging the degree to which one is not all-powerful, the degree to which one cannot triumph in that world of make-believe. You have to come to terms with reality. You have to come to terms with history. And most importantly, you have to come to terms with mortality. I don't think Cheney ever thought the era of conservatism would die. But when you looked at that helicopter take President Bush away, that was the death of the era of conservatism. You see, and that's worthy of celebration. At the same time, hypercapitalism is still around without the goods, without the confidence in the banks. You know, so what do? Well, we got to do what FDR did. We've got to do what working people in the 30s did. You have to do what women did in the 60s. You have to project new visions. You have to organize, mobilize, and be willing to live, and some willing to die for something bigger than them.
Dr. West, can Barack Obama, can any national figure of his status break free of the demands in the international arena of everything from the Israeli lobby to decades now of foreign policy that are based on militarism rather than humanism, that are based on materialism certainly rather than humanism? And I say this particularly as we watch events unfold in the Congo on one hand and the slaughter that just took place in Gaza, the unmitigated, outrageous, uncommented on slaughter.
No, I think that certainly Barack Obama can't do it by himself. I think that if he wants to be a statesman and not just a politician, that he can align himself with social forces and social movements of progress that can enable him to do it. When Lincoln took office, no one would have thought that he would align himself not just with the abolitionist movement, but with 200,000 black men in the Union Army that would break the back of a white supremacist slavocratic order. That's unimaginable. Lincoln went in wanting to put black people in Costa Rica. He was a supporter of colonization. My dear brother Eric Foner, the finest of all American historians, makes this point over and over again. Lincoln grew. He developed. His greatness is in his willingness to mature. Malcolm X was the same way. His greatness is in his willingness to mature as he tilted toward the poor. Will Barack Obama be willing to grow and mature and tilt toward the weak? If you're going to talk about Lincoln, you're playing with fire. Don't wrap yourself in the cloak of Lincoln and not be willing to grow like Lincoln. Lincoln was a thermostat. He wasn't a thermometer. He shaped the climate of opinion. He didn't just reflect it. He taught the people. The second inaugural lecture was one of the greatest of all of teaching texts of a politician. You teach the American people, you got to grow up. Democracy is too precious. We've got to empower folk against the grain. That's what Lincoln was about. Will Barack Obama meet that challenge? I pray for him. I'll be there to help him, but I don't know.
I'm going to pick on one other figure, and that is David Paterson, who many of us knew as a sterling, certainly friend of the urban areas, of his people, of, yes, left liberal causes, seems to be a bit unrecognizable now in the context of the governorship. Is there something inherent to the electoral arena that creates historic divesting of memory and recognition of what one was before for the sake of political expediency and longevity of power?
You know, that's a good question. It's hard to say. I mean, Brother David Paterson, I've always had great respect for. But power certainly is seductive. At its worst, it corrupts. The fact that he wasn't elected, I think, makes a difference, as opposed to Barack Obama being elected after a two-year campaign. And also, therefore, I think David Paterson is anticipating what his election will look like, or what his campaign to be elected will look like. I just don't know. But I don't think it's inherent in being a politician to be complacent, to somehow unwilling to be courageous, tied to ideals that are bigger than just the next election, or being politically expedient as opposed to morally courageous. I hope that's not the case. We know politicians who have stepped forward, like Lincoln and like FDR, like LBJ in relation to Black Freedom Movement, not LBJ in relation to imperial occupation of Vietnam. So that David Paterson, I pray for my brother. I love the brother. We're going to see what happens. Sister Mimi, it's always a blessing. Always a blessing.
Thank
Take
you,
care.
Really.
Take good care.
Thank you,
thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Crisis, intense drama, and painful trauma. But come what may, everything's gonna be alright. Yeah. The darkest hour, just before the dawn. Weeping may endure for a night, but there's always joy in the morning.
if things are falling apart. On the global front, there's Iraq, Afghanistan, Asia and Africa. On the political front, we've got mediocrity and mendacity. And on the economic front, arrogant bosses, not enough jobs with a living wage, inadequate health care, unavailable child care. But our spirits are still buoyed up by our memories of those who came before and our vision of where we know we can be. Recognizes the ground of our being and the source of progress from womb to tomb.
It's gonna be alright.
This too shall pass. Everything gonna be alright.
You were listening to Dr. Cornel West, a public intellectual and a sometime hip-hop song composer as well as author, and that is Hope on a Tightrope. We're going to listen to one of my favorite young poets, Aya De Leon, a smashing spoken word artist, kicks it with her contribution to the moment, the historic benchmark of the assumption to the presidency of African American President Barack Obama.
Have you ever seen somebody wake up? Round marble rolling beneath the eyelid just before the lashes blink apart. Sleep, the leading cause of waking when we got gas, houses, everything prices rising and the nation goes from complacent to disgruntled and don't nobody want to stay this whack-ass course. South American mountain ranges murmuring, turning over in their sleep as the body of Bolivia feels the massage of a million indigenous feet marching for Evo Morales. Have you ever seen somebody wake up? A roommate, a lover, a baby, that moment of where am I before inkwell pupils adjust to light? And I know some of us have been feeling despair and depression, but I don't care how much Prozac Big Pharma prescribes. Can't nobody keep the human spirit asleep indefinitely? I said, somebody is getting ready to take the red pill today because I have seen queer kids whose families have thrown them out on the street, left them for roadkill, stand up, rip the tire marks off their skin, and prophesy. I have seen survivors of rape reach inside themselves, rip the violation right out with a shriek that is part rage, part terror, part triumph. I know everybody doesn't make it. Eyes sometimes close and never open again. But if we got a 50-50 chance, then I choose to believe that some other human race on some other planet Earth will be the unlucky one, because I have seen lashes part, seen curving brown girls decide never again to trade sex for crack, seen mushrooms suck poison out of the earth and belch rose petals, and badasses like Indigo Black Chavez gonna go thug wild on some petroleum crack and rock the block on those at their own game. Crew so tight, even political coups can't see the light. So if Cuba can stand strong and black and green and socialist 70 miles outside Miami and indie hip-hop still ain't dead. Then we got brown South Bronx environmentalists cool enough to stop global warming, and Obama is only the beginning. I suspect some coalitions building with the ancestors. I heard the Kennedys been kicking it with Crazy Horse and Sojourner Truth, while Confucius and Che and Jesus and Albizu been chopping it up with Emma Goldman. But when Bayard Rustin came in to organize everyone together, Mahmoud Darwish came in to write the poem, while June Jordan invited the murdered teens from Oakland and all the legions of Iraqi children to have their say, and Tupac had to throw down a freestyle verse while Selena, Nina Simone, and La Lupe started to improvise on top. I heard it got so hyphy up in there that in the nearby realm of the unsettled soul still not at peace, Bull Connor and Heinrich Himmler wish they still had bodies so they could put on Obama t-shirts. Cause I said, however many freedom fighters the FBI and CIA killed, that only means we got more warrior ancestors to whisper in our dreams, rolling marbles under 5 billion eyelids, upper and lower eyelashes, kissing each other goodbye. 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is not where the power lies. It resides in these bodies, connected with these opening eyes. The ancestors cannot be confused by the views from the pews and the hues of the red, white, and blues on Fox News. I know some of us are running scared on some Rip Van Winkle, worried we gonna sleep forever, but have you ever seen somebody wake up? Brown, blue, hazel marbles rolling under lids, every shade of skin in every bed, pallet, mattress, sleeping bag on this rotating earth. Only a matter of time when somebody's surfacing from dream, smelling grandmama cooking breakfast and singing a freedom song. Somebody waking up on some liberated indigenous soil. I said, only a matter of time before we got so many marbles rolling in the rhythm of the earth and united ancestors whispering in our dreams, and we see we can win this thing and the people finally wake up.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.